About This Podcast, your hosts, Ed Hammond and Diego Kaminker, talk with global leaders in healthcare informatics about the evolution, current status, and future of healthcare interoperability in their regions and worldwide. This podcast is sponsored by EMEA IASI and HL7 International and is produced by HL7 Argentina. Ed and Diego select 5 questions for their guests and then let them answer freely. The questions are randomly chosen live from a longer list, so they'll be surprised and their guests will be surprised too. About our sponsors. About the Academy. The International Academy of Health Sciences Informatics was established in 2017 under the auspices of EMEA, the International Medical Informatics Association. It promotes the dissemination of informatics-based knowledge and best practices, fosters new ideas, and encourages worldwide collaboration and sharing of expertise and resources. About HL7 International. Founded in 1987, Health Level 7 International is a not-for-profit, ANSI-accredited, standards-developing organization. HL7 is supported by more than 1,600 members from over 50 countries, including 500-plus corporate members. About HL7 Argentina. HL7 Argentina was founded in 1999, making it one of the oldest HL7 affiliates. HL7 Argentina created the HL7 Fire Fundamentals course, which has educated about 7,000 students in HL7 standards worldwide since 2008. A little about your hosts. Diego Kaminker has defined, implemented, and maintained hundreds of healthcare interoperability projects using the major HL7 standards. He's an Academy Fellow and is currently an Affiliate Director on the HL7 International Board. Ed Hammond is Chair Emeritus and Founder of HL7 International, Chair of the Standards Panel of EMEA-IASI, and creator of the original HL7 Messaging Standard. For more details, be sure to check out the podcast notes.
Hello, we are from sunny Sydney in Medinfo 2023. My good friend Ed is with me again. And we also have here Jack or Ju Chuan Lee. And there's a lot of things to tell about him, but I'm getting old and I don't remember, so I will need to read, but that's my problem. So Professor Lee is a pioneer of artificial intelligence in medicine and transnational biomedical informatics. He has devoted himself to evolving the next generation of AI in patient safety and prevention, or earlier medicine. He has also been deeply involved in international cooperation for biomedical informatics development in Asia, America, Europe, and Africa. He is currently serving as president of the International Medical Informatics Association, EMEA. So you are our boss. And previously served as Vice President of EMEA and President of the Asia-Pacific Association for Medical Informatics. Besides, he has been elected as a Fellow of the Australian College of Health Informatics in 2009, the American College of Medical Informatics in 2010, and the International Academy of Health Science Informatics in 2007. Wow. Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you.
So our first question is always the same, and it's how did you become involved in healthcare interoperability standards or maybe medical informatics? What was your drive, your personal drive?
That's a good question. Since I was in medical school, my first year was very challenging because I saw this medical textbook, and it's crazy how much things we have to remember. And whenever I memorized the first chapter, I kind of forgot
most of the content when I get to the next chapter. And during the examination, we're supposed to memorize everything, all the bacteria, all the parasites, and then all the diagnosis, and all the treatment, and all the manifestation, symptom, signs, and all that. So I think there must be a better way to do this besides memorizing everything. So I started to use my Apple II computer. And we don't even have a hard drive. We have a floppy disk. And when I bought the floppy disk, I was the envy of my class because nobody has a floppy disk. Everybody used their 48K, 64K memory on board, right? And we started to write a program that would memorize all the diseases and their symptoms, okay? And then we add some lab tests and things like that. And we did everything on a language called Pascal, but we used a program called Turbo Pascal, and then we put it on the disk. And I even have to write how to allocate a sector on the disk and store the data on a specific sector. So it's very low level kind of programming. And we managed to write the differential diagnosis program, but then we get to a problem because we don't have knowledge. We have to input the knowledge manually from the books. So I asked three colleagues from my class, which read the most books, to give me some help. So they each created a diagnosis, like a scenario, right? So a specific diagnosis with symptoms and signs. And then we put three diagnoses into the system, and we were able to differential the three totally irrelevant diagnoses. That's my first expert system.
So tell us a little bit about the search routine. You put the data there. Uh-huh. How did you find, what was your input?
Okay.
How did you query it?
Right, so the input is diagnosis and symptoms and signs and other manifestations. And there is an ad hoc score that's assigned to each symptom is how important it is for that diagnosis. Okay, so it's a little bit like QMR. But I did not know about QMR back then. That's very early. So in my senior year, like my fifth year, somebody told me, oh, there are already programs in the US that's been doing this. So I read about QMR, and there's no internet, you know, so it's very hard. You have to get, I actually got a piece of paper, which is an admission kind of a flyer from University of Utah, and says, we have a program called Medical Informatics. Yes. And I was like, wow, there's a program called Medical Informatics under the School of Medicine. How amazing, you know, people like myself. And I was like very exceptional because nobody actually plays computer in my class. We're all medical students, and we're overloaded with everything else, right? So I was thinking, yeah, maybe this is the way that I want to do. And actually, I was more interested in computer than medicine when I was in high school, because during my high school, my third year, senior high, Apple II was introduced.
So give us some years so we can sort of place this along the chain.
Yeah, so that's 1984 when I graduated from high school.
Okay. Yeah.
So 1983, I started to have my first personal computer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And this was this program was around 86, 89?
Yeah, so I started the program in 1984 because we don't know what happened around the world. Okay, we're just, you know, in a vacuum, and we have computers and we have textbook, that's it. And we did not even know, you know, there's no PubMed, I cannot search anything. And, you know, if I go to my library, they wouldn't carry anything about medical informatics at all on paper. I've never heard about medical informatics back then.
And you taught yourself how to program?
Yes. I told myself, and I actually published some software. Before this, I published a software. It's a nutritionist. It's an electronic nutritionist that tell you what to eat and calculate your, it's like a calorie counter.
Yes.
And also with a workout table that you could pick what kind of workout, what kind of food you eat, and you end up gaining weight or losing weight. And we published that, and it's been quite a hot sell for the software company for 2 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
Were you involved in some interoperability projects too in your country?
That's when I finished my PhD in Utah, and then I went back to Taiwan. That's 1995. So in 1995, I was in charge of the hospital IT system as well. And we have a Japanese system, you know, and the system was very bad, and it went down a couple of times, maybe 3-4 times per week.
Oh,
and whenever,
very good friend.
Whenever we have a downtime with the HIS system, the whole lobby of the hospital will be full of people. They're waiting to get the bills and everything, and it's kind of a riot happen waiting to happen. And there was this one time, there's one patient that's been waiting for too long. He took a baseball bat and he went to the CEO's office and he threatened to kill the CEO if they don't fix the hospital. And that's a real story. You know? And the CEO came to me. His CEO is an OBGYN doctor.
Yes.
In Taiwan, we call them superintendent. Yeah, they're like CEO plus the chief medical officer in one person. So he was seeing patient, and then suddenly somebody with a baseball bat. And then the guy who wanted to hit the doctor, but instead he hit the wall and the wall got broken. Anyway, so
nice beginning for interoperability.
Right, so then he came to me and said, this is not gonna work. You really need to figure out a way. And I just took over the position. So I was studying what happened. And it turns out, you know, it's a very, very weird bug because most of the day it's fine, but then one day then it's down, right? And every time we restart the system, it took like 3 hours and it's really bad.
Yes, yes.
You know, restart everything, you know, re-indexing, and you know, it's crazy. And then we found out whenever we have five of the patient, when they show up, we have a downtime.
Okay, these specific patients.
Yeah, these five specific patients, when one or multiple or several of them register for that day, and then we'll have a downtime at that day. And of course, they're not hackers. I mean, back then, there wasn't no internet. And we end up finding out their names have a conflict code with the Japanese system. Because the Japanese system, although they use kanji, they can display Chinese characters. But these names have some character that has a conflict that trigger the bug in the system, and then
yes.
Anyway, so we decided to replace it. So use a Microsoft Windows NT, and we run a SQL Server and everything. And in 1997, we have the world's first web-based CPOE, wow. Computer Precision yes. Order Entry, using IE 3.0, imagine that, Internet Explorer 3.0.
So you appear to have understood technology to the extent of knowing how to take advantage of what was necessary
yes.
to make the system usable.
Yes, yes.
Mostly from pain.
Yes. Well, yeah, through the hard way, yeah, that's true. But interoperability wasn't a problem before I fixed the system, of course. So now we have the hospital fixed. The next thing is, how do we talk to other hospital, or how do we become interoperable with other hospital? So I advised the Minister of Health, who is I first advised the Chief Secretary of Health. He's a kind of a friend of mine. He's older, but he's a friend of mine. So I demonstrate to him what internet looked like, you know, what a web browser looked like, how do you use email. So he kind of became my computer friend. And then I told him, we need to do something to start the interoperability. So back then, in 1999, we proposed something called Medical Information Exchange Center. Okay, so the government is to found a center that facilitate the exchange of information among the hospitals. So of course, so we have continuity of care, we have all that, you know, after we have interoperability. And the hospitals were like, what is that? You know, why should we do it?
Why should they do it?
And what's in it for us,
yes.
Right? So back then, it's mostly research project.
Mostly research.
Yeah, it's mostly about, can we do it or not? Not why are we going to do it? Right? Because most hospitals, they don't really care to read other hospitals' information, and they don't want other hospitals to
yes.
read their information. It's customer information, right? So imagine a bunch of restaurants, they would not want to share the customer information if they're competing with each other. And for all the major hospitals, they're not in the same location, but when they're not that far away, they're kind of competing with each other. So yeah, usually they're very secretive about their data. And of course, some of the hospitals are still struggling with their IT system as well. But so I was able to get 10 hospitals, 10 of the highest level hospital, which we have only 20 first level hospital, first tier hospital, and 100 second tier, and about three or 400 third tier hospital. Third tier hospital is like 100 bed, right? And then the second tier is about 300, 500. The first tier hospital all have more than 1,000 bed.
And big hospital.
Yeah, big hospital, university teaching hospital and all that. So I were able to get 10 of them interested in the project. So we built exchanging servers and all that. It's also back then that I accompanied the chief secretary of the Ministry of Health. We go join HO7 as HO7 Taiwan. So we are one of
the first affiliate.
Right, one of the early affiliates with HO7 International. So after then, again, we've done that, but there's no real incentive to exchange anything. It's exchangeable, but then there's no good incentive for them to start to exchange.
And there was no regulation, no one telling them you have to do this or else.
Okay, that's why we think of something. So in 2001, we were able to convince the Minister of Health that we should return the health information back to the hands of the people. Because only when patient demands, right? So I go to hospital A and then I go to hospital B. I demand hospital A to transfer my data to hospital B or give it to me so I can take it to B.
And how did you transfer it? On a floppy disk or?
That's a very good question. But we thought it's a good incentive for hospital to be willing to do it, right? So the first implementation was we put everything on a USB drive. And you can just apply and get the USB drive back home. I actually presented this project in NIH for the NIH fellowship course, also at Harvard. So you can take and you can go home and you can read it because it's a CDAR2,
yes.
XML.
Yes.
With CSS. So you can just open it with any browser you like.
Yes.
You don't need to install anything. You just put it in there. So you can look at it. There are some fields you can put things in, but mostly it's read only. You can put things in, but it's for them to read. And then you can take it to the next hospital. The next hospital could read it or they can read it and they can import it.
So the people bought into this, they were excited by this opportunity. Like, do you have a hard time selling it to the people?
Okay, that's another good question. We've had about 1,000 people tried it.
Yeah.
Most of them, they're happy about it, but it's not like very compelling that everyone have to do it. Because back then, the concept of information exchange is still quite foreign to most patients. All they want is to get the best care from the current doctor, right? They will not ask the doctor, say, go get my record, so that's good for me. Usually they don't want to say things like that. And if they take a USB to the doctor and the doctor say, I don't know what's this. I'm not going to spend extra time putting this in my computer and turning it on and read it. And even in some hospital, they close all the USB plug anyway. They don't let you plug anything. Yeah. So that's, of course, version one. And version two will be over the internet, okay? And we end up doing several prototypes until we were able to convince the National Health Insurance Bureau. We were lucky because I've talked to the minister of this bureau for many times, and they're like, oh, this is like a nest of bees. So if you touch it, it's gonna come out and bite you. So they're like, no, we're not gonna touch anything about data exchange. That's not our business. We're insurance. We're like CMS, right? They're like CMS. We only care about paying and getting paid. Okay. Data exchange, that's your business, not my business. So they're like very resistant for 10 years until one day I got a minister from the National Insurance. He's going to retire. And before he retired, 6 months before he retired, he wanted to do something different. And we told him, oh, this is time you change history. And then he did.
Before retiring.
Right. Because and every deputy in his room are against it. We're against it. And he said, no, I have to do this. He said, I don't care anymore.
So
the bees kind of bite me.
We talk a little bit. We use the word interoperability a great deal. What kind of problems do you have with trying to put hospital A data and hospital B data in the same record? I mean, was there problems with?
Okay. Well, the problem is actually to make it available or accessible. To store it, that's a different problem, right? So first we need to make it viewable.
Yes.
Okay. So back then, there are already people exercising DICOM DIR. So people will bring a CD-ROM, and they will put the CD-ROM. So for example, you've done a CT in hospital A, and you move to hospital B. Hospital B will say, can you get the CD DICOM DIR with DICOM DIR standard? You can't get the CT from hospital A, so I don't have to repeat your CT. Or if I repeat your CT, I know what to compare, right? So patient will go to go to hospital A and pay about 500 NT, which is like $20 or 18.
You need to pay to get your...
Yeah, because it's a CD-ROM. It's like a physical thing, and they have to do this work, right? They have to install a DICOM DIR server and all that. So, and $18, $15 is really not a lot to pay. It's much cheaper than the CAT scan, right? So they get the CD-ROM and they go to the hospital B, and the doctor will just insert it and read it. So that's already kind of the USB, you know, the physical token type of exchange. So now people start to realize it's really to their benefit to have this type of exchange. So we are able to convince the Minister of the National Health Insurance, and he decided, okay, we're going to have an app that everybody, every citizen, every people could read their own data from all the hospitals that reports to, that submit claims to the National Health Insurance, which is every hospital. We don't have a difference between public and private. Every hospital will submit claims to NHI, and they will reimburse everybody. So even if you're a private hospital, it doesn't matter if you're private or public.
So let's talk a little bit about the data content. For example, do these records contain lab data?
It doesn't. It did not contain lab data to begin with, but now it's all there.
Yes,
images,
yes, yes.
Lab, it's all there. It's kind of an evolution.
Largely it's notes.
Yeah, no, we start with just drug information and diagnosis.
Yes. Okay.
That's the first piece. And then we add lab data, and then we add image data, and then text reports.
But
still not patient, not doctor's notes yet. That's something, because doctor's notes, the quality are you know, good and bad. Sometimes they just type, you know, weird things.
Was cut and paste a concern or just?
Oh, cut and paste a concern. And also sometimes we will say, oh, this is a patient that's hard to, you know, communicate, and we have our way to say it. And sometimes it's just, you know, not very clear things. You know, in a bigger hospital, they tend to give more complete and and legible notes. But in some of the clinics, they just type A, B, C, and X, Y, Z, and they have their own code.
The notes are not related with billing.
The notes are not related to billing. It's usually the coded part, like coded drug code, lab codes, and stuff like that. So with that, now let me describe just a little bit. What we have now is an app that's being used by 7 million people out of 23 million people. So about 30% of the people already use it to look at their own data. And if you go to any hospital, so from the hospital side, even if it's a small clinic, we have 220,000 clinic, or it's a hospital outpatient clinic or inpatient, the doctor will be able to see the patient's data. When the patient carry a smart card, we use the smart, that's still a physical token. We use the smart card as the authentication. So every citizen has a citizen's card, and doctor has a doctor's smart card. And we have a card reader that can accommodate two cards. So when I put doctor's card in there and I put patient's card in there in the same time,
I'll like be opening a safe box.
Yeah.
In the bank.
Yes. Then I can read everything the patient's been experiencing. As small as a three drugs that's prescribed yesterday by GPs, I can see them, and I can see the data and all that. So now it's much, much better.
So, yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit too, because GPs are outpatient primarily.
Right.
And so when did you start mixing inpatient, outpatient?
You can also see the inpatient reports.
Yes, yes.
Your own inpatient.
Yeah, we can see our own. Of course, we can see our own inpatient with our own system. But with the card and the reader, we can open up a website and we can read all the what the inpatient visit, outpatient visit of that specific patient outside of the hospital.
So one more question. Because one time when I visited their country, a guru who did acupuncture liked to practice on me.
Oh, you did?
So did you capture any of that data in your...
Yes, yes. We
traditional medicine.
Yes, we call it TCM, traditional Chinese medicine. Yes. We are probably the only country in the world where all the TCM doctors were trained in Western medicine.
Fantastic.
Yeah, they have to get a Western medicine license before they get a Chinese medicine license. So they use ICD to as their diagnosis.
Yes.
And they do X-ray, they do lab data. But most of the therapeutics are acupuncture and herbal.
And you drugs. Have a special code to code that, the specific
procedures? Oh, yes, yes, we do.
And so you have your own set of points you record. I mean, location, intensity, depth, and all of that.
Yes, yes.
Because we're starting to talk about in the U.S. and other countries now as part of ISO, we're beginning to talk about the inclusion of traditional medicine with Western medicine, not as separate, but including all of that.
Yeah, almost all the major hospitals have this department. It's a department of TCM. And they have their attending physician residency, just like any Western medicine department.
Yes.
And they have all their own subspecialization and stuff like
that. So we learned something important, I think, with that.
We always learn. So you told us what you have already, and what I want to ask you is, what do you think is missing in your system? What do you want to see that you're not seeing?
What I like to see is more communication from the doctor to the patient and back to the doctor after we see the patient, after the patient encounter, because there's no channel to communicate with the doctor after you've seen the doctor, right? After the patient-doctor encounter, there's no way that you can communicate with the doctor. So every time, even you want to ask a small question, an easy question, you have to register and go to the clinic.
No telemedicine.
Yeah, well, yes. Telemedicine was used in the during the COVID-19 period. Yes. And interestingly enough, maybe 80% of the telemedicine during COVID-19 were for TCM, because there's we do have a TCM drug that's proven to be quite effective for COVID-19, and that was it was free. I mean, once you're confirmed by the doctor that you have COVID-19, you can get prescribed that for free. So 80% of the telemedicine were used
to prescribe
that TCM for COVID-19. But now after the COVID-19, there are much less people using it. People still want to see their doctor, and it's easy for us to see a doctor. You know, we don't have a long schedule appointment.
And you have a very small copay.
Small copay, and you can almost always get to see some doctor the same day you want.
Wow,
yeah. That's great.
And you get if you need to do an MRCT, you know, that kind of expensive examination, you almost always get it in a week.
And you don't think that will continue in the future? Okay.
Yeah, that's something I'm worried about, because the healthcare budget, of course, have been growing several times since 1995 when I first go back. It started as 150 billion NT. Now it's about 900 billion NT. So over from 95 to now, okay. So it's going to grow, you know, but there's a limit. So we are facing also a similar problem around the world. All medical professionals, they have to see more patients to get lower pay. And they spend more time to get lower pay. So burnout is a big problem.
Well, so now we are talking about genetics. We're talking about social determinants of health. We're right. talking about nutrition, all of these sorts of things. What do you think the future is, and particularly AI? Is this going to be received by the practicing docs and the patients?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. Because the problem that grows up budget and the burnout issue, you know, it's been a very drastic growth, but it's still not enough. And that's keeping me awake in the night that we're going to lose this kind of health insurance when I'm older. You know, that's been giving me a nightmare.
Yeah.
And I'm paying for it all my life. And when I'm older, I need it, it's gone, right? So I think with AI and more personalized data,
yes.
okay, we're accumulating, like you say, genetic social determinants, we are accumulating more personalized data. So hopefully one day we have personal big data. When we have personal big data, AI will be able to use to do a personalized prediction. If we can predict personalized health to a certain degree, we will be early to do something I called earlier medicine, meaning we do every step of medicine earlier, from prevention to diagnosis to treatment to rehabilitation. But every step that way, we do it a little bit earlier. So earlier means less cost, better quality of life, right? Better survival, right? And again, less cost. I said already, but yeah.
So in the U.S. right now, the biggest huge focus for appropriately is equity, diversity, and inclusion. Is that a focus as well for?
That has been taken care of. You know, a group of people are under a special health insurance that there's zero copay. So we do have the other side of the problem is those people tend to use more healthcare resources because it's zero cost for them. So if you have chronic disease, but you're kind of a low income people, then almost everything's free. And if you have a catastrophic disease like cancer, then you also automatically qualify to these disadvantaged people as everything's free, no matter what your income.
So there's trauma, a large group of people that are trauma issues?
Yes, mostly traffic accidents.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Trauma it's been much better because of the we put on the helmet. we have a lot of motorcycle, and people used to drive motorcycle without helmet. Once the helmet law were enforced, and it's funny that we had the helmet law for a very long time, but we never enforced it. So once we enforced it, head trauma or traumatic brain injury were reduced 75%.
Wow.
Wow.
You know, it's one, just enforcement of law.
Now we talk about exchange between hospitals and exchange for patients. What about public health? What is the level of exchange from providers to public health?
That's a good question. So I would use CDC as a example. The head of CDC is an informatician from Columbia University, a PhD from Columbia University, student of George Ripsek. When he came back to Taiwan, he was very keen in terms of collecting data in order to do all this infection and syndromic surveillance. He collected a lot of, so he established another data channel from all the hospitals, starting with the ER. Okay, so from the ER, he already connected like 300, 400, almost all the ER in Taiwan. They're feeding real-time data to CDC. So of course you can do a syndromic surveillance. You have no problem with you know what's happening right away. You know, today and tomorrow, how many people get stroke because of the temperature is reduced 10 degrees yesterday, and now you have more stroke and asthma. And they have all kinds of data like that. So that's been a good use of data. Now they're of course, after COVID-19, they become almighty, and they can get all the data they need. Right. Using that, you know, you can get anything. So that's a That data has been instrumental in many public health policies. And we also have another agency called the Health Promotion Agency or Health Promotion Bureau. They are in charge of the chronic disease promotion and the cancer screening and things like that. But they're not very informatics yet.
Yeah. So let me ask one other question. Going back a little bit too, but in a hospital, you've got all these different clinical departments. Do you do anything different in cardiology, nephrology, and OBGYN, et cetera? And how do you manage the different departments, both in terms of data as well as in terms of process?
Okay, again, that's a very good question. So usually the last mile are the various machine and an instrument that different department would use. For example, in the cardiology department, cardiac echo were used very often, treadmill EEG and regular EEG. And even now we have EEG you can bring back home, you know. Besides Holter monitor, you have this long-term EEG you can bring back home for 2 weeks. So how do you connect all these machines? So we do have a couple of companies that specialize in a black box that you can connect to almost any machine and output HO7 data. So that was a very successful clinical model. So that data box can connect like 50% of the machines, including hemodialysis machine and you know some imaging machine. So we use a box kind of to solve it. But the company will have to solve all the data interface one by one. But I think starting like 10% or even 5% of the machines, now they're getting to like 50% of the machine. But 50% of the variety covers about 80% of all the numbers of machines, mm-hmm. right? So of course, there are still some last miles that we're not getting
there. I think we will have to finish because he has another commitment. But we always, for the last question, mm-hmm. we do the reverse question. You have to ask a question to us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, our last question is not for you.
Okay. For me to ask. Yeah. So again, I would just give you back the question, what should be the next step for our situation? So now you have a draft picture of what we have. What should be the next big step?
I'm impressed with listening to you because mm-hmm. I think you have been really a pioneer, not only for Taiwan, but also really for the rest of the world.
For the rest of the world.
And I'm learning a great deal from you. What I believe now is number one is patient. Mm-hmm. And we have to recognize the fact that patients are not stupid, open word. They're a lot smarter, a lot more sophisticated than they used to be. They used to be afraid to ask a question of a doctor. Now with everything Googling and I sometimes with a little bit of tongue in cheek say the patient knows more about the disease they have than the GP does because they have a vested interest in that. And I think that's changing.
Right.
You've hinted at some of this as well in terms of personalized medicine. I think if patients are more apt to behave properly, so I think that's the biggest thing that I think is going to change. And I think the future is going to be both personalized and precision medicine. I think with AI, and you certainly did a beautiful job of when you're introducing in your talk earlier with artificial intelligence and how that gets used. And I know I'm quick on to finish, Diego, but I think that patients are going to really understand much more of their own problems. I think with artificial intelligence, precision medicine becomes a reality. And I think you're going to have better outcomes of that. I think you're going to get behavior changes, recognizing that this behavior, my comment is if before birth, I can predict a lifetime, if you do everything I tell you to do. But if you start doing something on your own, then you begin to leave that curve. Mm-hmm. And it's up to you individually to understand that and bring it back. So that's sort of I could talk all day on that. But I think it's a good question, and because I think that's extremely important, because I think that's what we need to focus on in the future.
Thank you very much.
And we've got the tools to do it.
Thank you very much, both of you. And it was a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you.